Backseat Producers, episode number 237, Chariots of Fire. This is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And we are the Backseat Producers. Welcome.
Hey, it's
continuing summer.
Oh, yes. If your summer is long, hot, and dry like ours has been.
We actually got rain the other day, though.
I know. I woke up that Sunday and said, like, what's that noise out there? Oh, my God. It's wet stuff. It's falling from the sky.
Wet stuff falling from the sky. It's the end times.
Yes. Beginning to think I was living on Arrakis.
Yeah, so like a week or two ago at my son's, he goes to camp during the day, during the week. And they go to a park, and that's where the camp is. And for about 2 weeks, there were some chalk drawings where some of the kids had drawn start and finish lines. I guess they were doing races of some type. Well, chalk drawings normally only last a day or two.
Yeah. They wear those, off or wash off.
Those chalk drawings stayed for almost 2 weeks because we had not had any rain to wash them away. I've been half tempted to go out and every time it rains, like the day
touch
after...
Touch them up a bit?
No. Oh. Just go out to my driveway with some of the kids' chalk and just write the date on it.
Just
to see this was the last time it rained. You know? It's been crazy. It's funny though, because normally in a normal summer you can kind of tell the neighbors that are watering their lawns. This year it's bloody freaking obvious.
Yes, the neighbors across the street, they have been watering their lawn like every hour. It's green and everything, but every one of us is just let the damn things burn up. Hell, crazy enough to put that much water on them.
I
should say, Matt, one neighbor down the street, his yard is about the size of a postage stamp, so he can water it with a bucket.
Oh, sure. Yeah, one of the husband of one of Julie's cousins posted a picture on Facebook, and he's like, yeah, you can't tell where the laterals for the septic tank are, can you? And he took a picture of their yard, and there were just these two strips of just pure, thick, luscious green grass just surrounded by brown. It was like, well, that's where the septic tank is.
Yeah, well, the thing is, a good time to see where them water pipes are leaking.
Yeah, yeah.
Funny thing, in the morning when I take a shower, I can't get any cold water out of the thing. It comes out body temperature because the heat has penetrated past the frost line now.
Yeah, and Julie was even complaining about that the other day. She's like, I never thought I'd say this, but I can't wait for winter because I can't wait for actual cold water to come out of the cold water tap.
Yes.
To get drinking water.
Right.
You know?
You have to put a whole bunch of ice cubes in and they melt immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
You feel like anymore you fill up the cup full of ice and put a little bit of water in and it's like, then you'll have ice cold water, but not ice water.
No. So we're going to continue this, the summer series here for a little bit. We've picked out a few more movies. We've done a little bit of research, and some of these are available on Netflix. One is available on Amazon Prime.
If
you have Prime, which I do, so yay for me.
You'll be free.
And there's one of them that no matter what, you're going to have to either check it out from a library or
iTunes or Hulu or somebody.
Yeah. So what we're looking at for the next couple of weeks, we've got Car Wash, Bad News Bears, the original.
Yes, not the horrible remakes.
No, not the sequel or the remake or anything like that. Both of those are available on Netflix Instant Streaming. As of right now, they are.
Hurry up and watch them before they change.
Sometimes that changes. Fortunately,
situation is very fluid with Netflix anymore.
We are recording on the first of the month, which a lot of times they cut stuff off at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So we might be okay for a while on these. Next up, we have Stand By Me, which is the one that we couldn't find in a free streaming mm-hmm. or, you know, pay to stream format other than.
So it's going to be either iTunes or Hulu or somebody.
Yeah, somebody that you're going to pay to see it. And then the last one is National Lampoon's Vacation, which we found is on Amazon Prime.
So for all you lucky Amazon Prime customers, it is free. If you're not, it's still pretty reasonable.
At some point in there, we will likely toss in The Dark Knight Rises just as a we need to talk about it.
A more current, yes.
Yeah, have you seen it this
morning? I'm going to go try to see it this Sunday.
Fantastic.
Me and my dad are going to get go Sunday night when there's almost nobody in the theaters.
I was yelling at my my phone, which is what I stream all my MP3s through right now. I was yelling at my phone this afternoon while listening to Funny Books with Aaron and Polly. And the sheer amount of wrongness that they were about the movie and some of the comments and criticisms of it. So I will gladly do a point by point dispute of Aaron's point by point problems of that he had with the movie.
Everybody's got an opinion, like a yep. butthole. You know?
That's right. That's right. And we hope to be seeing the faces of Jill and or Adam David soon, within the next couple of weeks
after he returns from his educational quest.
Yes. His vision.
By the way,
quest.
He does have his master's degree now.
Yep.
For those of you who haven't been following along, he is now has a master's degree.
Yes. Yes, he does. And the podcast is officially over at this point. It is done. So let's go ahead and jump into what we're here to talk about.
Right.
Chariots of Fire.
Yes. For those of you who were fortunate enough to watch the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, this movie figured very prominently in there. They had for those of you who haven't seen the opening ceremonies, they had about midway through, they had an orchestral rendition of it.
Oh,
and
nice.
Of course, on the keyboard synthesizer was Mr. Bean.
Nice.
Who essentially started daydreaming and checking his email on his iPhone and inserted himself into this movie. It was a very nice little tribute there.
Yeah, so for the early 80s, was this late 70s, early 80s?
82.
82, okay. So for the early 80s, this movie had one of the most iconic and distinct soundtracks.
Right, courtesy of Vangelis.
Yes, and I got to say, the soundtrack won awards. I believe it won an Academy Award.
Yes, it did, for best soundtrack, yeah. Believe it or not. This movie won a significant number of Academy Awards for, and also won a couple awards at Cannes, too.
Yeah, and I got to say, this music, it's dated. I guess I'm kind of spoiled on orchestral scores as opposed to... Now the keyboard work, like the piano work, is great.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets into the synthesizer stuff,
but that's
it
very,
dates itself.
Well,
it,
yeah.
It's dated for the time of that the movie was made, not the period that the movie's about, but the time the movie was made.
Right. But again, this is 81... This is the kind of the beginning of the synthesizer age. I mean, so it's interesting that they went for a modern soundtrack to cover a period of the 1920s. Well, yeah, the 1920s. So this takes place between 1919 and 1924.
Right.
And I think it works fairly well. I mean, it's not the only... This was kind of one of the first movies that did this. I mean, we reviewed Lady Hawk sometime back. And they used Tangerine Dream as the soundtrack. It was very interesting for a movie set in the Middle Ages to have an ultra-modern soundtrack.
Yes.
But it worked, surprisingly.
Yeah, it was fun. The Tangerine Dream soundtrack there evoked the fun and excitement and adventure of it.
Mm-hmm.
It really did.
Yeah, it was an interesting take on it. But, you know, this was kind of beginning of this use of modern soundtracks for, say, a costume drama or a period piece. It didn't detract from it. It actually, it's, of course, and again, now we're speaking 30 years later. I mean, we're used to this.
Right, right. And I think it was just one of those things that, you know, you hear that those very clear, distinct piano notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets into a synthesizer, and it almost is jarring.
That's a little abrupt, yes.
It's not that it's bad. It's just that it's not what I have grown accustomed to. You haven't seen it yet. We talked about The Dark Knight, but The Dark Knight score is orchestral and encompassing and enveloping, and it's like it's huge.
Well, it's meant to be because
right.
we're working with a legend here.
The orchestral set of new score, myths. But the orchestral score has, you know, even through the 70s and 80s, really kind of has come into being and
its own. Yeah, well, the sound field and the incidental music in a movie anymore is what makes or breaks it.
Yeah,
more people will probably remember that particular musical score than they will a particular scene,
right.
Or they will associate the both together. How could you have Star Wars without the John Williams opening?
Right. Right.
I mean, the first thing you hear, the Imperial March, boom. Oh yeah, you remember all those scenes that it's attached to.
Yes.
Chariots of Fire is the exact same way. In fact, yep. it was the first movie to really invoke that type of emotion.
Yeah. Whenever I hear that those series of chords starting out at the piano, I see people running. I see men running on a beach. You just see it. I mean, it's just there. I know I watched this movie once, probably in 84, 85, so it would have been like 13 or 14. I had no appreciation for it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have that very distinct memory of that music, guys running on the beach.
Right.
It's also become kind of a pop culture icon.
It is.
Just that, the music and the guys running on the beach.
Right. Which, by the way, is the opening and closing scenes of the movie.
Right, right. What did you think, high level, of the movie?
It's a great movie. I mean, it's a period piece. It's a little slower, but it's a nice little drama. I enjoyed it. I mean, I haven't seen this movie for years, but I'm now going back and looking at it again from a more distant point in a different place in your life, you really can appreciate this movie a lot more once you sit down and watch it.
Yeah, it's got some interesting themes to it.
Yeah, very interesting themes. For this day and age, would probably be more important than the time they were even created.
Right, right. I did have some problems with it. I didn't think it was as great as all the mythos surrounding the movie and all the accolades that it got. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was that good. It was a good movie, and it's got some interesting things to talk about. But I thought the acting was okay. I thought the dialogue was clunky. The dialogue was a mouthful of words that people wouldn't say the way those people said them. It was trying to evoke a period of the genteel upper class kind of,
yeah, circa 1919 in Cambridge, England.
But even so, the way they said those things just didn't make any sense.
Well, maybe not to us as an American, but as to a British audience, it might make a lot more sense.
I mean, it's not that the dialogue didn't make any sense. It's just, well, I couldn't see people talking that way.
We don't have any documentary movies from the 1920s, so we really don't know how people did it, how people really talk to each other in everyday conversations.
That's true.
Some of the liner notes of this movie said this. A lot of the dialogue was based on a journal that the journal of one of the characters in the movie.
Yes, it felt very much like written work,
mm-hmm.
like a literal translation of written work. And some of the conversations really felt more like they were plotted out in writing,
mm-hmm.
more than prepared for a screenplay, because the dialogue just didn't seem to flow very naturally to me. And that's, I mean, you know, I know that I wasn't around in the 1920s, but it still, it was, it threw me out of some of the scenes because I felt like they were talking down to me with how they were talking.
That may be an intentional.
We are better than you by talking like this. That you lay people can't understand the concepts that we have. And
that may have been an intentional, not an exact intentional feature, but it's a side effect of the dialogue.
Yes.
But it evokes that same period drama.
Right. The thing is I didn't care for. I just didn't mm-hmm. care for that feeling. It didn't work for you. It wasn't endearing to me. Mm-hmm. Let me put it that way. The polite racism
mm-hmm.
and anti-Semitism is apparent like from almost the beginning of the dialogue of the mm-hmm. movie. We have a character, Abrams,
yes.
who they make mention repeatedly is a Jew. If you couldn't figure it out,
he's a Jew at Cambridge too.
He's a Jew at Cambridge. So, of course, he's not going to be singing in the choir.
We assume, although he's a huge Gilbert and Sullivan fan.
Yes, yes. That was amusing, but the polite racism, I noticed it right away.
Oh yeah,
and it's at first I was like, wow, is this just an effect of the time? And as you watch the movie, it's like, no, that's a theme throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. They're establishing early on that they're looking at this character as a second-class citizen,
mm-hmm.
especially at Cambridge.
Right. Well, he mentions that in the dialogue that his father had to work himself up to his position in where he was.
Right.
And he was, you know, they were always, you know, like, kept out of certain professions.
Yeah.
And of course, they may mention this. When the one the head of the college is in the drawing room there, and he says, "I hear his father is in finance." And he said, "Well, what's that? It has something to do with lending money."
Yeah.
Okay. A little slap there.
Yeah. And there were a lot of little slaps throughout. I mean, it was pervasive. Mm-hmm. It really was. So Abrams goes to win the court run challenge.
Right, he's the first one who was ever supposed to be able to do it.
Right, and what this basically consists of is being able to run the
circumference of the courtyard before the clock
strikes 12. Yes.
Well, finishes the last stroke at 12.
Right, and he and another character in the story run it against each other.
Mm-hmm.
But Abrams is the one to do it.
Right.
It follows Abrams through some of his trials, and eventually we get introduced to this character, Eric Little.
Mm-hmm.
Little.
It's Eric Little.
It looks like Liddell in the text, but mm-hmm. it's Little. And he is devout Christian.
Right. Proto-missionary.
Yes. His family were... He was actually born
in China. Yes, Scottish parents who were on the mission. Who were on a mission in China.
Right. And he races as well. The two of them early on race against each other, and Little wins.
Mm-hmm.
Little,
much to Abrams' surprise.
Yes, Abrams seems to almost have this. This era complex with he's entitled. He knows what he's doing. He is a racer and he runs, and by God, nobody's going to beat him. And Little comes and beats him.
Well, not only beats him, but he crushes him in fact.
Yeah. Which kind of sends Abrams into a spiral.
Well, yeah, he doesn't take losing very well.
No, he doesn't.
As he says, I don't race to be beaten. I race to win.
Right.
And he doesn't take losses very well.
Yeah.
Much to the chagrin of his girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, he dresses her down hard. That was uncomfortable to watch because she's like, come on, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. He's like, I do not race to lose. I race to win. And he is like in her face yelling at her, I race to win.
I wouldn't say he's yelling at her, but he's taking a pretty hard line that this is important to me. You may not think very much of it, but I take it personally.
As much as these genteel types are going to yell.
Yes.
He yells. Mm-hmm. So he goes out and gets himself a trainer.
A personal trainer, yes. For this time, it was a very, very, very unusual thing to do.
Yes.
Well, actually, he doesn't get a personal trainer. There is one there who is watching him and agrees to take him on. He said, I'll take you on if I see you're worth it.
Right. Right.
Which, again, this guy kind of approaches him.
The personal trainer
mm-hmm.
is Bilbo
mm-hmm.
from The Lord of the Rings. He's Ian Holm, who plays the older Bilbo
mm-hmm.
in the Lord of the Rings movies, and is apparently reprising the role for the Hobbit as he is going back and telling the story.
Okay, he's reciting it.
Yeah.
Back.
So Ian Holm plays that trainer.
Yes,
and that was kind of cool.
Yes, I kind of like his thing. I like they're quizzing him on the fact that he has a personal trainer, and he says, "Is it? He's partially Italian." Well, ain't good. He's only partially. The other half is Arab. That's it's like he throws that out there.
Yeah,
in your face again.
The racism is pervasive. It's not just Jews. It's
Italians, Italians and Arabs.
Islam, Arab. Yeah, it's all over the place. So flash forward to 1924. They're getting ready to go to the Olympics in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And just as they're about to board the boat, they're at basically like a press conference. And somebody asks Little, so how do you feel about racing on Sunday?
Yes, knowing that Little is a rather devout Christian on this matter, more so than probably any of us would ever be.
Yes,
but he really takes this stuff deadly seriously. Well,
and his family is very religious, mm-hmm. and like at one point earlier than this, he missed a choir practice or something.
No, it was a meeting.
Okay.
He was late to it, and he got there late because he was doing all his running, and his sister dressed him down. Well, dressed him down. She's practically having hysterics.
Yeah.
That he is putting his running ahead of his religious duties.
Yes.
And he takes her aside and gives her the story that, you know, God created me to run and run fast.
Yeah. And when I run, I feel that I am
praising him. Yes.
Praising God.
Yeah, she thinks again all in terms of, you know, the black and white. You're either in or you're out,
right? Mm. And she's doing that, and mm. then later he gets to the point where he's telling his handlers
mm-hmm.
from the Olympic Committee, the English Olympic Committee, you know, hey, we need to do something to change this. They're like, you run for the king. Mm-hmm. He's like, I run for God.
Yes.
Well, God appointed the kings, so, and he's like, no, that's not how it works.
Well, he tells them essentially where his principles lie.
Yeah, and that was pretty good. He said, look, this is the way it is, and this is what I'm going to do. And if you don't like it, I'll just get on a boat back home. This is the way it's going to happen.
Yeah, there are more, the thing is, the head of the team tells him not to worry about this too much initially.
Right.
Because we're going to talk to the Olympic Committee and see if we can't rearrange something.
Sure.
Well, unfortunately, that's too big a pride thing, apparently, for them to go to the quote-unquote frogs, French,
yeah.
and ask them to make an exception or make a change. So they're going to try to, like, bullhead him into... of course, the solution turns out to be terribly simple.
There were a couple of minor characters that that we had followed, one of whom, early on in the Olympic competition, won a gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered his position in the 400.
Yeah, Lord Lindsay.
Yeah, Lindsay. Who's Lindsay had won.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered his position to Little for a different day. So mm-hmm. he could run on a different day, so he wouldn't have to worry about
it. Right, he'd run the 100 meter, and Little would run the 400 meter.
Right. At another point in the story, Abrams wins. He gets his
he silvers in I can't remember exactly what competition. But yes, then he gets his head handed to him in the next one.
Yeah. So there's a nice sequence. The weird thing about this in terms of like other sports movies, so in other sports movies there's always the build up to the big event.
Right.
You have
the signature,
the big game, the big boxing match,
the big play.
Yeah, the
defining moment.
That big moment. For them, it's a 400-meter relay. It wasn't even a relay. It was a 400-meter race, which doesn't last very long. So the actual race itself is almost kind of anticlimactic because it's so quick. It's not. I would have bet if this movie was done with a modern director, that race would have lasted about 10 times longer than.
Well,
a real
even
race
with
would have
the lasted. Slow motion. Parts of it, it does go on, but the thing is,
it's pretty quick.
Yeah, but still, it's not about the race. It's about the aftermath of the race.
Well, and it's about the build up to the race too, because the Americans, everybody kind of underestimated the American team, and the Americans have been kind of kicking ass,
right?
And it's Little comes into the 400 as kind of an underdog. That, you know, nobody's really expecting him to do well. The American coaches have flat out told their players, you know,
don't take him seriously.
Don't take him seriously. He's used to racing 100 meters. He's going to hit 300 meters and he's going to die. This guy is.
He's done two races previously that day. He has his tank's empty.
Right.
They tell him. So, you know, just hold back and when he chokes, then pass him.
Yeah. And so then the Americans are the good guys because an American runner. One of the American runners first tells another American runner, yeah, don't listen to what the coach said because...
This guy is deep.
Well, and he said, this guy is running for a reason.
Right. He's got something to prove.
He's got something to prove. And then one of the runners actually goes up to Little and kind of hands him a note of encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
And says, hey, you know...
We approve of your stand on principles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something I would have done, too, if I had been thin. But you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, you are a good guy. Regardless of the race, regardless of everything else, we are
behind
enemies
on
the pitch,
mm-hmm.
but we believe in what you're doing and the reasons you're doing it. And we're led to believe that that note is what really motivates him and gives him an extra boost to go on and win the race. And win it, he does.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets to come home with the gold. From there, the movie is basically over. There's a little more follow-up.
Well, yeah, the fallout of all of this, that the Abrams and Sam has had his validation that his more modern training techniques are valid.
Right.
And that he has actually been able to prove this with a gold medal. And him and Abrams are in the bar getting their schnot-faced there, and they're sitting back and they're relaxing and said, who cares if the world wants to go to bed? You know, we just won friggin' gold.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting to juxtapose the Jewish runner versus the Christian runner. Who wouldn't run on the Sabbath versus the Jewish runner who was really being looked down on because his handlers at Cambridge were not, they did not, absolutely did not approve of him using a professional trainer
mm-hmm.
because their belief was that a professional trainer means that you're doing this all for the money, even though you're not a professional. By you paying that trainer, he's going to train you as a professional, and it's not going to be about the good of the team, and it's not going to be about the good of Cambridge and how you represent us.
Yeah, you're supposed to have
us.
Done everything yourself.
Right, and it's about how you represent us.
Mm-hmm.
You have just made this about you and you winning gold, not about bringing home gold for your country. You have made this personal.
Mm-hmm.
As if it was a bad thing. And in their mind, it was. In their mind, that was a bad thing. And and it's kind of funny looking at the Olympics now where
we praise individual
accomplishment. You know, yes, it's great that you're a part of a team, but also you can excel as an individual, and that's okay that you excel as an individual.
And you can make something of this afterwards.
Right. Look at like Michael Phelps, who as of the recording of this is now the most
medaled
Olympiad
of all history.
Period. Yeah. In modern history. Mm-hmm. We don't know about what came before. But yeah, I mean this guy is what he is the descendant, you know, the spiritual descendant of somebody like Abrams, mm-hmm. who worked and strove on a personal level to
and was win. Willing to, well, yeah, also willing to put a lot on the line too.
Yeah, he did make some interesting choices along the way. He pissed off his girlfriend. He made people at Cambridge unhappy with him. There was a few people even on his team that weren't real happy with him because he was so driven. And what's interesting to me,
well, that's just it. They're not taking it seriously. He is, because he has something to prove by being driven.
Yeah. One of the things that was funny to me was how the other guys, the Lord, what's his name? I can't think of his name right now. The guy that gave up his position in the 400 and Montague.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed like, hey, we're getting to go also. And they approached it, they almost approached it as if they were being picked for the varsity ball team,
mm-hmm.
and not that, well, you're being honored by your whole country to go to the Olympics. Those guys are like, yeah, yeah, we're getting to go.
Yeah, well, that's the difference between someone who has a sense of entitlement and privilege and someone who really has to work at being there.
Right, right. It was that the way they portrayed that was really nice.
Lord Lindsay,
yes. And then Montague was one of the other ones that went
mm-hmm.
along.
Mm-hmm. But they were friends of Abrams, too.
Right.
But the thing is, that's the huge difference, the social gap between these guys.
Yeah.
There's one interesting scene in the beginning of the movie when Abrams and Little are riding in a taxi and they get to the registrar's office. And, of course, Adam's going first. The registrar asks him, oh, well, laddie, what's your name? And after the little interrogation is over with, he says, by the way, I'm not laddie anymore because I was in the war, and I'm no longer referred to as laddie. Do well to remember that.
Yeah,
that he dresses good. That guy down almost immediately,
yeah.
to remind him, hey, I'm no boy here, son.
Yeah.
I've seen the elephant, so you respect
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I'm a young man, but I've been to war. I've been to the Great War. That was World War I. I mean, mm-hmm.
Well, he missed a lot of it, but
well,
he still was an officer. He still had a commission. There. He was still there.
He was there.
And he, like the one, again, here's the interesting little dialogue back and forth was, he said, I had the bad luck to miss most of it. And the other guy standing next to me said, yeah, there's a lot of guys who wish you had your bad luck.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't have too much more to say. I mean, I think I've kind of touched on all the points. The acting was okay for what they were given. the acting was fine for the dialogue. Again, I wasn't all that crazy about the dialogue, but what was there was performed well. And whenever you have somebody like John Gielgud on the screen, it's kind of hard not to be just like enthralled watching the guy. Mm-hmm. He's just that good.
Well, also, this is a fun movie, again, to watch now as a contrast between the Olympics of 1924 and the Olympics of 2012.
Oh, my God. The opening ceremonies. The opening ceremonies. That was almost amusing to watch. How quaint, really, it was, as opposed to the spectacle.
Yes, each one comes in with their own little marching band, and like the whole thing seems to only take maybe about an hour to get everybody on the field.
If that.
And like you look at the countries that are represented there, it's like, okay, maybe about 30-some countries able to make this thing and put actually some athletes on the field. and the size of the stadiums, and but you know, the for still the Olympics craze is still going on. The posters are all over the place. The bar cafes and bars are full.
Yep.
The excitement's still there, just on a little smaller scale, and it's still a huge thing. You know, everybody shows up to the dock to wish the boys off to the event, and it's a big deal.
Yeah,
it still is. It's just bigger.
It's a lot bigger.
It's just as showy.
yeah, I don't really have a whole lot else to say. I think it's worth watching, especially if you know what you're in for. I didn't really know what I was in for. I didn't know what the movie was about. I knew that the movie was set in and around the Summer Olympics, and I knew it was in the 20s. I didn't even know which Summer Olympics it actually was, but I didn't know of the religious undertones and the
class struggles
and class differences that were being represented. I just didn't know that. I think if I would have known that a little more, I might have been more in tune to it right from the beginning, and enjoyed it more from the beginning. But the point, I was probably a good half an hour into the movie before I realized, oh, that's what we're talking about. You know, it's like, yeah, there was the definite pervasive racism and anti-Semitism that was going on. And at first, I wasn't sure if that was a point of the movie or if it was just a product of the period that they were talking about. That it was just, we're going to show you this to show you that it's the 1920s and it's a different time, you know, as opposed to, no, this is really one of the big sticking points of the movie. This is one of the themes that they were pressing.
Well, also the fun thing, too, is the movie opens up in 1978 with the funeral of Abrams, I believe.
I think that's right.
Yeah, Abrams.
Yeah.
And two of his colleagues from that time are still alive. And, again, when this movie came out, there were probably still people alive who remember this story as it happened.
True.
It would have been at least familiar with the 1924 Olympics in some manner of speaking, because, again, two of the members were still alive. Now, the show note says that they played a little fast and loose with the chronology there.
Right.
Some of them had already passed many years before and would not have been alive to attend this funeral. But still, there would have been people alive at this time who would have remembered it.
Right, right. Yeah. They had the nice little tag there at the end telling, you know, where everybody was at that point.
Mm-hmm.
That Abrams and his girlfriend went on to get married, and
he became the head of the British Athletics
Association. Yeah, I thought that was kind of neat. And then Little died in 45.
Yes, in occupied China.
In occupied China. But as a missionary.
Or as a missionary. Well, he said he was going to be a missionary.
Right.
He'd already accepted that. He just wanted to get this thing out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, they make a joke of it in the movie there after it's all done. He says, well, I guess this is all you've got this out of your system.
Yep.
Yeah. And I guess he had or had not. I mean, we don't really have any idea. I mean, a little more digging and Googling might find out what happened, what his career was like in China. Who knows? He could have set up a running craze there for all we know.
Yeah, it very well could have. So I don't think I have anything else for this one.
Mm-hmm.
I will just say,
still worth 2 hours of your time if you got nothing better to do and you kind of want to look at a nice, again, a look at the Olympics before it went terribly, terribly commercial.
Right. And I would also caution that it is a slower movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
It's a period. It's, again, it's a slow moving period drama. It's a
slow moving period drama from the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. It's a character study.
So it's not. It doesn't have the quick cuts. It doesn't have the long.
Yes, it follows the Zack Snyder's. It follows the Zack Snyder school of slow mo occasionally.
Occasionally, but not to the point of.
Yes, it's
doing
not
a whole 100-meter race in slow mo just so we can see every detail of.
Because the agonized race, look on their faces.
100-meter race lasts seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's No, no, we don't need all that. But it is very much a period drama, an English period drama, so you know what that entails.
Keep that in mind.
Just be aware of it. And if you go, if you know that going in, I think you'll have a better appreciation of the movie. And kind of understand that it is, there's some religious themes, this movie really isn't about running.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is about conviction and belief and what
and
you're willing to do, what how far you're willing to carry your convictions and your beliefs. That's really the key to both Abrams and Little.
Mm-hmm.
Where for Abrams, his belief was that he was the best, and that if he worked to improve himself, he would be the best. Where Little's was about being faithful to who he believed he was and what got him there, and what he believed that to be was his God first and his country second. And he stuck by it.
Yeah, for both men of convictions.
Both,
but
men
different, but approaching it from a different angle.
Very different angles. Yep. I think for that, it's definitely worth seeing, just to see how driven they were toward their goals, competing goals as they were.
Yeah. Big question is at the end of the movie: if you were in this position, what would you do?
Right.
Would you be as faithful to your convictions as Little, or would you be as driven as hard as Abrams? Or would you just be fall back on your sense of a privilege entitlement?
Which was very definitely represented by Lord Lindsay and
But Lindsay at least but Lindsay practiced. Lindsay did his hurdles.
He did.
He did his work.
He won. Mm-hmm. I mean he was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had a sense of entitlement and some,
but not
from an outside. Mm-hmm. From an outside, you could call that arrogance, but it was confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was kind of believe that the difference between confidence and arrogance is the ability to actually do what you say you can do. If you can actually do it, then it's just confidence,
mm-hmm.
and that's what it was. He was privileged. But that privilege afforded him the luxury of being able to practice,
spend time on training
to practice and train.
I liked his training for the hurdles, his full champagne glasses on each one, and say, "Okay, tell me if I spill a drop."
Yeah, and the same with Montague. That it was just, you know, for them, it wasn't. It didn't seem to be as big of a deal.
Right.
It wasn't. It was just what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just who they were. And I did like how it represented that idea also. That it wasn't just about people who were so driven in one way or another. It was also about people who could just do it. They didn't kill themselves for this.
No.
But they enjoyed every minute of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like that too.
So I guess we've covered pretty much Chariots of Fire. So
yep. Next week, let's go ahead and say we're going to do Car Wash.
All right.
And shortly afterward, Bad News Bears, Stand By Me, and National Lampoon's Vacation. And
Car Wash is going to be a jarring change from Chariots of Fire.
That's fine. We need a jarring change over the last couple of weeks.
Interesting comedy, too.
And don't forget, at some point in here, we will be slipping in with The Dark Knight Rises. So. Mm-hmm. Don't be surprised if we change our order up just a bit.
We
buck the schedule just a bit to get that in there, because
we know you're dying to talk about it.
I am. I am dying to talk about it. All right. We'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks for coming.
See ya.